Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Reyes, Judge Frick, Honorable Matthew Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is July 15, 2020. Today, this panel of the court has three cases set for oral argument, each of them by the WebEx video conferencing software. I'd like to do a quick sound check. I assume that my two colleagues can see and hear me. If you could give me a thumbs up, I would appreciate that. Very good. And let me just check with counsel for respondent. Can you see and hear me and see everyone? Ms. Hahn?
Yes, Your Honor. I can see all of you.
All right. And I can see and you hear, see and hear you as well. We will begin in a minute with Mr. Heisler. As you know, each of you has 15 minutes for your initial arguments. Appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. The time clock should appear on your screen. You can probably see it now, but I think no matter which format you choose for your view, I think that the time clock will be visible somewhere on your screen. If you can't see it, feel free to let me know. I want to make sure that you are aware how much time you have remaining in your argument. Mr. Heisler, assuming that your sound is working correctly, you may begin.
Check that. Do you hear me, Your Honor?
I do. Yep, hear you loud and clear.
Okay, thank you. And please the court and counsel, from the position of the appellant in this case, the case can be capitalized really by Judge Kajikov's characterization of Charlene Hendricks, the appellant, in response to the motion for amended findings in this case. And his quote is, on behalf of Ms. Hendricks, I'm going to spend my time going to casinos and gambling, and I expect Mr. Hendricks to continue working his breaking down body. And I think it was Judge Kajikov's determination or his feeling about Charlene Hendricks' gambling issue that pervaded and was pervasive and affected almost every ruling that he made in this case. There were, I think, 30 pages and an hour of testimony all over objection on each visit that Ms. Hendricks made to a casino. Despite the fact that there was no issue in this case as to money for a casino being budgeted, there was no issue as to any dissipation of assets, and there was no issue as to whether or not Mr. Hendricks would be responsible to pay any debts that Charlene Hendricks had incurred as a result of her casino gambling. In short, the entire issue was completely irrelevant. When I asked Judge Kajikov as part of the objection on what the basis for relevance was, his response was that it was relevant because Ms. Hendricks was claiming that she cannot support herself. I would suggest to the court that that's a very dangerous standard to apply and one that should not apply. How an individual spends discretionary money that's not related to any issue in the case becomes really fruitful ground for the exact kind of bias that happened here. The judge may or may not like a particular activity in which an individual engages and makes a judgment on that, as the judge did in this case, to decide what should happen in other areas of the case, and in particular, whether there should be maintenance, how much the spouse of maintenance should be, whether the individual is employable, and all of that. The judge concluded, and he has at least a couple of comments, that he felt that Ms. Hendricks was capable of working because she could drive to a casino, and I think one comment was, and the other one was, that she can sit in front of a slot machine. Two vocational rehabilitation specialists testified in this case, and neither one said or even attempted to claim that the ability to go to a casino and gamble was a qualification for any job in any field at any time. In fact, Dr. King, I think, specifically said that that would not suggest an ability to work. And I think if you just think of a couple of examples, a paraplegic could wheel himself or herself in front of a slot machine and gamble. That certainly wouldn't indicate that that person was not disabled or was qualified for any other particular job. From that determination with regard to the gambling issue came a number of conclusions by the judge and a number of them that he ignored in terms of the facts of this case. Among those were that Ms. Hendricks was not in the job market for 24 years, was 58 years old, had no training or education in bookkeeping. Her work product was deficient, both in terms of the testing that was done, in terms of the witnesses, and in particularly in terms of the bookkeeper who succeeded Ms. Hendricks, who described her work product as shocking and convoluted and messy and cloudy. And in fact, it was so bad that Ms. Foote scrapped Ms. Hendricks' entire system and started over. It took Ms. Hendricks excessive time to do her work. That's an undisputed fact in this case. Mr. Hendricks attested to it. In fact, it, as it turns out, it took Charlene Hendricks 35 hours to do bookkeeping work that should have been done and was done by Ms. Foote in 10 to 12 hours of work. Ms. Hendricks was chronically ill for many, many years, and that illnesses, those illnesses are well documented, and they include chronic pain, depression, anxiety, panic attack, migraines, PTSD. She was taking narcotic strength pain medications. And I note that the testing that was done by Dr. King, to which the respondent's expert, Ms. Schroth, actually agreed, the testing, there was no problem with the testing. Ms. Schroth accepted that. And that testing verified all of the things that Ms. Hendricks was claiming, including that she could not do her work in a timely fashion, that she was way below competitive range in the very field that the court now thinks she should be employed, which was bookkeeping. And I know also that...
Counsel, I have a question along those lines. Was there any medical diagnoses by a medical doctor introduced indicating or opining that she was unable to work?
There was no opinion that she was unable to work. What there was, I think in two different occasions, there was an opinion by a doctor that it would be very difficult for her to enter the competitive labor market. And
are you referring to Dr. King?
No. In her medical records, and I believe it's, I referenced that in my brief, but there are two occasions in the medical records where the doctor is discussing with Ms. Hendricks the possibility of working, and the doctor says that it would be very difficult for her to enter the competitive labor market. I brought that up in the motion to amend the findings, and Judge Jacobs' response was, well, the doctor said difficult, but not impossible, thereby establishing impossibility as apparently the standard the judge was applying as to whether or not Ms. Hendricks could engage in work in the competitive labor market.
Right, but having difficulty working is different than being unable to work. Sure. It's not an issue of impossibility, but whether she's able to work or not. And I didn't see anything in the record indicating any testimony from any medical doctor that she was unable to work. And I think that's one of the key issues here.
Well, and if I could respond to that, it's not that Ms. Hendricks was unable to work. She could work, she was working at home, but the problem is that the time that it took her to do the work, number of hours that she spent dealing with her medical and physical issues, which are all well documented, would sometimes be incapacitated for half a day. She was taking narcotic pain medications. Her work product was awful. So the question is, even though she may be able to work, is she employable in the competitive job market? I think that's what the court needs to look at in terms of, or physically, could she sit down and do some book work? Yes. But the question is, could she do it well enough and in a fashion and timely enough so that she would, for all practical purposes, be employable? I think the answer to that clearly was no. And that's the conclusion that Dr. King came to.
Well, Mr. Heisler, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Reyes.
I was just going to say, just to follow up on that, but isn't that a credibility determination? And didn't the district court not credit Dr. King's testimony, but did credit Schrott's testimony that she is able to work, that she could find a job?
Well, and I think what Ms. Schrott made a couple of assumptions, which turned out not to be the case, which was that she had good skills and they were updated. Ms. Schrott, her own testimony, was not aware of the deficiencies that were inherent in Ms. Hendricks' work product, more of the time that it took her to do the work. She assumed in her testimony that her skills were up to date, accurate, and could be performed proficiently in the marketplace, and that simply is not the case.
But we generally do not question the district court's credibility determinations with respect to experts as to ability to employ. The district court found Ms. Schrott's testimony credible and found Dr. King's testimony not credible, in particular because it was based primarily on her testimony that she's disabled.
But again, there were some very important factors of which Ms. Schrott was unaware that were revealed in cross-examination that she didn't take into consideration in making her opinion. And when those points were made, when she wasn't made aware of those points, the response was, that's definitely something we'd have to look into. Qualified her opinion because she realized she didn't know what those restrictions would be, what the deficiencies were in Ms. Schrott's work, in Ms. Hendricks' work product.
Right, but that's for the district court to determine what testimony to accept or what not, and we don't question that on appeal.
I understand, but I think that it's important to note also, Judge, that Judge Kajakub didn't find any of Ms. Hendricks' testimony not credible. He just simply ignored it. He made finding that she suffered from a variety of illnesses and symptoms, but made no finding as to any symptoms. Ms. Hendricks testified at length regarding those symptoms and how they interfered with and interrupted her day. And I think, you know, the court didn't say, well, that testimony is not credible. In fact, it was consistent with the testing that Dr. King did, accepted by Kate Trott, but simply ignored those factors and how they might impact her ability to work. So I'm just saying, even though the court may have found Ms. Schrott credible, you also have to look at the evidence in the record, including Ms. Schrott's own testimony, that there were a number of things that she didn't know when she arrived at the opinion that she had. And she qualified that when she became aware of it.
Mr. Heisler, I have a couple questions about the first argument in your brief has to do with the temporary interim mediation agreement. And I'd like to focus on the $1,000 per month for consulting services.
Yes.
I've seen the agreement. Could you please tell me, sir, what testimony is in the record concerning, I guess, two issues. First, the formation of the agreement and what the parties intended by that consulting feature of the agreement. And then secondly, what was the testimony in the record on both sides with respect to whether Charlene fulfilled her part of that agreement?
I don't think, Your Honor, that there was any testimony regarding the intent. I think the document was clear. It spoke for itself in terms of what was required. Testimony as to how that was implemented. Ms. Lori Foote, the bookkeeper, testified that in response to a specific question I asked her, was Charlene, to the best of her knowledge, always available to consult with regard to bookkeeping? And her answer was yes, as far as I know. In other words, Ms. Hendricks was always available to be consulted, but Ms. Foote made it really clear that she had no intention of consulting with Charlene because she thought her product was horrible and that there would be no benefit in consulting with her if she scrapped the entire system and started over. Those were Ms. Foote's words. So
I believe the district court made a finding, a fact, I don't have it directly in front of me, something like that was not done, or basically no consulting services were performed. So is it your view that that's incorrect?
Well, it's correct that they weren't performed, but my position is, Your Honor, that in order to consult, somebody has to consult with you. A question has to be asked. Ms. Foote has to go to Ms. Hendricks and say, what about this, what about that? And Ms. Hendricks has to be available to respond. Ms. Hendricks had no duty as a consultant to go to Ms. Foote and try to figure out what questions Ms. Foote would have. It would be up to Ms. Foote, who was clearly aware that Ms. Hendricks was available, said she remained available. And I think that was Charlene's obligation, not And she fulfilled that obligation, even according to Ms. Foote.
Thank you.
There are a number of things where I think the decision of the court was lopsided, and those included things such as the treatment of the respective parties in terms of contribution from their live-in adults. Ms. Hendricks was not only expected to maintain rent from her son, but the court ended up splitting the total living and food expenses, and the effect of the court's order was to require her son to pay more money than he was currently paying, and required Mr. Hendricks' live-in to pay nothing.
But Mr. Heisler, isn't there case law saying exactly that, saying that the expenses of an adult child paid by the obligee, or any gifts from the obligee toward adult children, are not part of the reasonable expenses of the obligee? Isn't that a matter of case? I don't believe this district court cited the case law, but isn't it true there is such case law?
Case law, can you rephrase that, Your Honor?
Case law saying that when determining an obligee's reasonable expenses, it is permissible for the district court to exclude any expenses of an adult child being paid by the obligee, or any gifts made by the obligee to an adult child. You know, the theory being that adult children should be supporting themselves. It's not like minor children. And that so these are voluntary, gratuitous expenses or distributions incurred by the obligee, and therefore they're not considered reasonable. I believe there's case law to that effect. I'm asking you whether you are aware of it and whether you would distinguish your case from that case law or otherwise.
Well, first of all, I think if the judge is going to take that into consideration, that the treatment should be fair and equal as to both parties, but then that might be a good point, Your Honor, in terms of the food and whatever contribution that was paid for food on behalf of the adult son, but her rent was what it was. It was the full amount of rent that she had to pay. And so to the extent that the court required her adult son to pay more money for her rent than he was currently paying, I think that was unfair because the court made no such a requirement of Mr. Hendricks' living.
Well, so as I recall, the son paid $400. She paid how much?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but
he paid less than half.
He paid $400,
which is less than half of the total, correct? Yeah. And so,
yes,
didn't the district court say that her reasonable rent amount was half of the total? That was the district court's finding, correct? That her reasonable rent expense was half of the total, which was less than what she had been paying because she was allowing the adult son to stay there for less than half.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. And my point is that if as a live-in, he's required to make that contribution, the same contribution should have been required of Mr. Hendricks' live-in as well.
Okay, thank you for your argument, and you will, as I said, you will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Hahn, on behalf of the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. Mary Hahn, on behalf of Ronald Hendricks. This appeal, respectfully, is a kitchen sink appeal. Every single finding of fact, 10 separate issues are being appealed, all of which are findings of fact. So the standard of review across the board is abuse of discretion. What is interesting to me about Ms. Hendricks' brief is she never articulates how exactly for this reviewing court the findings are not supported by the record. She has not shown how any finding is clearly erroneous, particularly when our reviewing court must view the record in the light most favorable to the district court's findings, and that is.
Ms. Han, there's appellant wife certainly does raise a lot of issues, no question about that. But I mean, that's certainly her prerogative in terms of what issues to raise, whether it's one or a dozen. But I actually wanted to follow up on the last issue that had been raised with respect to the contribution from the live-in. The district court seemed to require contribution from wife's son who was living with her, but didn't require that by husband's live-in. Why is that not an abuse of discretion? It seems like what's, in essence, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Why shouldn't the district court have required that of husband as well? I don't quite understand that.
Sure. Concerning the monthly expenses of wife, Mr. Heisler and I went back to the court after trial on Mr. Heisler's motion to amend the findings, because the court had failed to include a specific finding concerning wife's reasonable monthly expenses. So we had a separate argument on that piece. But in addition, through the record, what's important is a couple of things. One of the things that the court cut, if you will, or reduced from wife's monthly expenses was over $500 charge for HSA. And then the court cut in half her rent and her dining out expenses. So it was not just rent. The court took rent and dining out expenses because it also included adult son's dining out expenses. And that is finding of fact 17 on the amended findings at addendum page 41. What we introduced in evidence, Your Honor, globally, and this goes to the global equity of the court's decision, is that the parties were separated 5 years. Marital funds were used to set the wife up in her apartment. They sold some marital assets, set her up in her own place in 2013. Over the time between 2013 and trial, wife made several choices that increased her monthly expenses considerably. And of course, that is her choice to do so. One was to move into a much more expensive apartment. One was to purchase a new vehicle, substantially increasing her monthly expenses. And that was a point that we hit on pretty hard at trial, while meanwhile, Mr. Henricks is driving a beater car with 185,000 miles on it and completely paying the mortgage on the party's homestead. So it is not simply the rent piece, is my point. This has to be looked at holistically and globally. So Mr. Heisler's point here today concerning monthly expenses, this was all raised at the district court level. These were arguments that were presented. They were presented on cross-examination, and the district court made the finding of fact that it did concerning her overall reasonable monthly expenses should be $3,596. And I would submit respectfully that should not be disturbed because there is not an abuse of discretion.
But I understand that the court will often take a holistic approach looking at everything in total, but we do have a situation here where you can have a direct apples to apples comparison. That's all fine and well. I'm not questioning what the district court did with respect to her cost. What I'm questioning is why the district court did not do the same thing for husband's costs, for the live-in contribution. That's what I don't understand.
And the district court did not include an analysis on that piece, Your Honor. You are correct. But I would submit that we need to look at the decision globally as well as the evidence in the record. When it found that Mr. Henrick's reasonable monthly expenses were in the 5,000 range versus hers, which were in the 3,500 range. But
is there something in the record that explains why the girlfriend was not in a position to contribute to the monthly expenses for husband's rent or mortgage payments? And I mean, I understand what you're saying, but Judge Reyes has is raising the same point issue that I have, and that is it seems inequitable to require something of wife but not require the identical thing from husband, and then there's no finding about that explaining why the district court made that choice.
My recollection, and again, this is my recollection from the record, that we introduced testimony, Your Honor, about the fact that Mr. Henrich's partner lived in the home with him and how they divided the chores, the labor, the groceries, and the utilities. So there was evidence, because this definitely was a point raised by Mr. Heisler concerning, hey, what about partner and what is she offering? And that was introduced into the record. Yes. Yeah.
I have a question about the law on this subject, and I don't know the answer, and so I invite input from both you and Mr. Heisler. But does the law treat obligees and obligors the same in this respect? I know there's a statute in 518.552 subdivision 6, which is addressed to modification of spousal maintenance if the obligee is cohabitating with somebody in lieu of marriage or instead of remarrying. And I'm wondering if the case law reflects the fact that that specific provision for obligors indicates a legislative intent that the same principles do not apply to the obligor. And is there any case law to that effect, do you know?
Your Honor, that's an excellent point, and I do not know if there's case law on that effect, but I think the point is a good one, that when the legislature amended the statute Your Honor is referring to specifically make cohabitation relevant for the party receiving maintenance, I think that does suggest that we really have to look carefully at cohabitation and adults living in the home of the party seeking maintenance. But I'm sorry, I do not have a case on that point.
Yeah, I don't want to make an argument for you, but I also, if the district court's order was based on existing case law to that effect, we wouldn't want to reverse it, perhaps, if that were the law. But I'm unsure of the law as I speak. I know you and Mr. Heisler probably do more family law than I do. So that's why I was looking for your expertise.
Well, and I would submit, and I'm not trying to minimize the rent, but that the fact that we're talking about just the rent was just one piece of the district court's reduction of her monthly expenses. It also involved eating out and the claim for her medical care expenses. So that was not the entire kit and caboodle, if you will, of how it reduced her expenses from $5,000 down to $3,500.
I have a question about the temporary agreement.
Yes.
Paragraph 4 says the party's business shall pay Shar $1,000 per month, representing compensation for her consulting services with the new bookkeeper. Shar shall cooperate in turning over the business books and records, including passwords. And shall continue to maintain the status quo for bookkeeping until the bookkeeper is secured. So what did Shar fail to do pursuant to that agreement so as to not be entitled to $1,000 per month?
I disagree with Mr. Heisler's summary of the record. And what came into the record was my client, Ron Henrichs, testified that—
Before you talk about the record, I kind of want to focus on the language of the agreement. I just want to understand at kind of a high level what your position is. You know, what did she not do that she was required to do? I mean, how would you summarize that point?
It was the consulting services. The consulting services piece was supposed to be the $1,000. And what happened was she just did not provide any consulting services. That's the big picture, the 30,000 foot view. And when asked to do so by Ron Henrichs, she refused. So that is a piece in the record. So
what did he ask her to do that she refused?
He And I was looking for this site in the court's findings, and I'm sorry, I'm not placing it. I'm not putting my finger on it. The testimony was Mr. Henricks reached out to his wife and asked her a question and please share with Lori Foote X, Y, and Z, and she refused to do so. And Lori Foote agreed with that assessment. So we have a little bit of a difference of opinion about what the record says, Mr. Heisler and I.
Okay, thank you for that. So I have a question too about the meaning of the agreement, because it, in the corporate world, let's, you know, larger companies than this, you know, quite often with departing executives or employees, severance pay is sometimes characterized as consulting services, quite often for tax purposes. So the HR people and tax lawyers know how to characterize it, but no consulting services really are performed. It's a bit of a euphemism. And I'm wondering whether, you know, this agreement should be interpreted in that way, whether it says $1,000 per month representing compensation for her consulting services, but you know, there's nothing about keeping track of hours, you know, and paying partial amounts, less than 500, less than 1,000 a month if less time is worked, and so on. What's your response to that comment?
Okay, this was not, as Your Honor said, sort of a, I don't know, symbolic or whatever term Your Honor used. At the time this mediation occurred, it was October 2017, and the goal was to try to get Ms. Henricks to stop working in the business, and the agreement, you know, speaks for itself. The compensation, you know, this business does not make a lot of money. This is not Coca-Cola. Money is absolutely tight. So $1,000 per month for compensation services. At the time, there was no replacement bookkeeper. There was no Lori Foote, who came in January of 2018. The other relevant piece, Your Honor, that came in during trial is that at that time, we didn't even have our forensic accounting report. We did not know the condition of the business, the position the books were in, that they had been overcompensating themselves, that the shaky ground it was under. It was a scary thing learned in 2018. This was all introduced at trial. So it was our position at trial that the business could not afford to pay this amount. And even so, she hadn't provided the services promised contractually, and the court agreed with us. And we asked for a complete waiver, if you will, or release of having to pay any remaining amounts to Ms. Henricks. And the court did not agree with my argument either, instead took the approach of reducing it by the $1,000 a month.
So well, the other obligations are unconditional, right? I mean, shall
yes.
pay health insurance, shall pay five, whatever. So
those were paid. Those were paid. Yeah, those were current at the time of trial.
I have one more. I'd like to move to one, to a different topic with one more question. The last argument in appellant's brief concerns the value of the business. The district court said it was zero. Appellant's argument is that it should be at least $18,000, which is the basically trade-in value of the vehicles. Mr. Henricks testified that inventory and equipment could be sold for pennies on the dollar only, but that the vehicles, you know, had a, he provided his own estimates in thousands of dollars, and they do add up to $18,000. I mean, isn't there evidence in the record based on his own testimony that the business is worth at least the trade-in value of the three or four vehicles that it owns?
I would say on that, Your Honor, we testified copiously about the pennies on the dollar and even the trade-in value of the vehicles, and wife did not present any testimony whatsoever on the point. And it was Mr. Henricks' testimony that the business has, in essence, zero value, and that was not rebutted or contested. And that's the finding that was made. And that was not an issue that I recall being raised in the motion for amended findings either. And Mr. Heisler can correct me on that. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Hahn. Mr. Heisler, as I've said, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'll use a bit of time for that. I think the expense issues are really they're indicative of what happened in this entire case. Look at the budget. Mr. Hendricks has in his budget, I believe it is $527 for uninsured medical expenses. He was granted that. The judge denied Ms. Hendricks the very same thing only because her uninsured medical expenses were paid through an HSA. The result of that is that Mr. Hendricks gets all of his uninsured medical expenses as part of his budget, and Ms. Hendricks, who has serious medical issues, gets none of her uninsured medical expenses. With regard to the vehicle, Ms. Hahn notes, well, my
Mr. Heiser, before we go forward on that, so I'm unclear about this issue of medical expenses. I understand that Mr. Heisler had an HSA account, but was not making contributions on a periodic basis at the time of trial. Is that correct?
That may be, Your Honor, but he still allowed his uninsured medical expenses of over $500 in his budget. It's fine, but Ms. Hendricks was denied $507 for uninsured medical expenses in her budget. So one party got those and one party didn't.
So is there any provision in her monthly budget for medical expenses?
There isn't any more. There might have been an insurance cost. I don't have it in front of me, but for uninsured expenses, there's nothing because that was removed by the judge. The other issue was Ms. Hahn makes reference to the vehicle, and Ms. Hendricks got a different vehicle. Should be noted that in Mr. Hendricks' budget, he has budgeted $400 and some for a new vehicle, which he doesn't even have. And so the judge made that accommodation for him again, sort of bent over backwards to allow him what expenses he was even anticipating, much less did he have, and did not do the same thing for Ms. Hendricks. And I would also point out, Your Honor, that with regard to the mediation agreement, and the judge makes no finding on this, but with regard to the mediation agreement, Mr. Hendricks never paid what he was supposed to pay, not ever, not a month. In fact, paid $1,000 the first month and the second month. And then when Ms. Foote got on board, he paid $1,200 a month. We never paid what the court agreed he would pay. And the court makes no note that he was continually in breach of that obligation.
I mean, the district court took care of all of those arrearages in its judgment, correct, with the exception of, I mean, the two things that you are concerned about are the $1,000 per month in consulting services and I think four payments that were miscoded, which the court labeled a fraud. Otherwise, I mean, the arrearages have been taken care of by the judgment, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Okay. And I would only say with regard to Ms. Hahn's example, that was a request made. Ms. Hendricks had an obligation to cooperate with the bookkeeper and to consult with her and was always prepared to do that. The incident that Ms. Hahn refers to was an incident where Mr. Hendricks asked Ms. Hendricks, and this is in the record, for a document that was inaccurate and wasn't up to date because she no longer had possession of the books of the business. And that's the only reason, and she testified to that. That's why she didn't provide it. It would have been giving the bookkeeper bad information. That was the only example where she didn't provide something she has to provide. And that wasn't a consulting thing. It was simply a request to transfer one document to another person. There was no consulting requested. And I maintain that you can't consult unless you're asked. So I think that was the agreement on Mr. Hendricks' part, not Ms. Hendricks' part. And that's all I have in response to counsel's remarks, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Heisler. It appears there are no further questions. And so the case is deemed submitted. Thank you very much for your arguments. And the court will issue its opinion within 90 days.